Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santaferadiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, Natalie Goldberg is going to join us, talking about her new book, which is about writing memoirs. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bill Hutchison. It's the first Wednesday of the month, so it's Animal Day here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Fabian Chavez joins us. He is the Director of Parks for the City of New Mexico. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
And we're here to talk about dog parks, ladies
dog
and
parks.
Gentlemen. Let's start with you, Bill. There's actually a dog park at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter. I didn't even know that. You've been here for years.
I know. Shocking, isn't it?
It is.
It's really one of the hottest topics, especially among dog people in our community, and Lord knows there are a lot of them. One of the things when we built our new shelter and moved into it 2.5 years ago was important to us was to give the community, especially out on the south side, a dog park that they could use. And over the years, over the last 2.5 years, the whole project has really undergone a lot of changes, and it's still in transition. We actually have a total of 5 dog parks out at the shelter. 4 of them are public dog parks. One of them is currently under construction and is just going to be for our shelter dogs and our volunteers. But we have the Gordon and Bess Miller Memorial Dog Park, which we opened up several months ago, which I'm not positive about this, but I think it's the largest enclosed dog park in New Mexico. It's about 20 acres, and it's all this really beautiful land that you see out there off 599. It's all enclosed, so dogs are really safe, and it's big, so there's lots of room to run and not get away. We also have 3 smaller dog parks that are about 1 acre each, because, as we all know, not all dogs are dog people. So these 1 acre...
Not all dogs are what?
Not all dogs are dog people. So for those dogs that are not dog people, we have these 1 acre parks where...
Do you mean aggressive dogs will come and knock your little dog Honey to the ground and turn her on her back and bite her?
I'm not saying. I'm just saying. So for those dogs, we have the individual dog park. So 1 person at a time can go into these 1 and change acre dog parks. And there are signs that we have up there. So if somebody's in there and they're hanging out with their dog, you don't want to go into that dog park. You can go into one of the other 2 individual dog parks that are next to it. Or if your dog is really good with other dogs, that really large community dog park is a great idea.
So do you get a lot of traffic from people in that, so to speak, neighborhood? Can you call it a neighborhood?
It's very difficult for me to get to work earlier than somebody who's already out at the dog park. We have a lot of people out there, and we've had a lot of input from users. You know, I don't know that we necessarily could have predicted how much use people on the south side and in general were going to be making of our dog parks, because as soon as we started constructing them, we got lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of comments from folks who were interested in helping us figure out the best ways to do things.
And so people, are they coming from far away to use them, or do you get the sense that it's sort of people from nearby? I suppose you can't really tell.
No, it's hard to tell, and I try not to plague them too much when they're down there, because certainly when I'm at the dog park, for me anyway, the dog park is a lot more about hanging out with the dogs than it is about talking to other people. But, we always have cars down there in the parking lot from the moment I get there in the morning till when I leave in the afternoon.
Fabian Chavez, you are the Director of Parks, which is... as you say, quite a wonderful thing to do. How many dog parks are there besides the ones by the animal shelter in the city of Santa Fe? And what is a dog park as opposed to just a park?
Well, that's an interesting question. There is one single right now currently designated dog park. That would be the Frank Ortiz Dog Park. However, most people are welcome to use all our other parks to take their dogs into. The difference is that at Frank Ortiz Park, you can take your dog off leash. It does say dog park. The dogs can run around loose. It's not fenced. The other parks in town, it's okay for the most part, except on a few parks that are signed. And those are heavily used athletic fields where we have little kids and we don't want the dogs on that park.
Or their excrement.
Right. So, and that's the key. Folks are welcome to use the parks, as all the other parks in town. They just have to be on leash, and they have to be able to pick up after their dogs.
And so, There has been a call for more dog parks from the citizens of the of Santa Fe. Is that not true?
That's correct. And
which means more off-leash dog parks.
More off-leash dog parks, and those calls come in from all over town. Councilor Patty Boucher a few years ago said, you know, parks, let's get after this. Rest of the councilors, let's get after this. Let's put some more parks in the other districts around town. So currently we are reviewing construction documents for two new dog parks that we'd be built this spring. One is a small dog park, about a little less than an acre, that will be on the east side of the Salvador Perez swimming pool and attached to that park. The second one will be a little bit larger, almost 2 acres, and that will be attached to the Villa Linda ball field. Now, most folks know the Santa Fe place as the Villa Linda Mall, so I still use that terminology. We're improving that field currently. That new field will be open for soccer and open play use. We're going to renovate that playground, and then just due north of that, there's a long stretch that goes up towards it used to be Toys R Us. That will be our third dog park. And so number two and number three are going to be built concurrently.
What is there now when you say built? Are they already parks or are they just paved over nothingness?
Actually, those fields are just big open space right now with native grasses and shrubs.
And so I imagine that in that kind of a district, they would have to be enclosed just because they're so close to roads and traffic.
Absolutely, in the urban dog park area, and we took a look at some of the models in Tucson that had dog parks out attached to wide open spaces. They were fenced, and they had some dog parks right downtown next to the Symphony Center and fountains, and they were all fenced. And in talking to the folks, we discovered, yeah, it's really important to have fenced off areas where the dogs can be kept secure, mainly from traffic in the urban areas. So both those parks will be fenced.
So I think it's great that you get to go out of state to visit other dog parks.
Well, the city didn't send me on this, but I was up there visiting my folks, and I was talking to some neighbors who said, found out what my job was about. The conversation evolved to dog parks, and they said, well, you ought to walk up the street and take a look at this park, because it's right in the middle of a very high-end neighborhood residential area. Now, that was interesting to me, because a lot of residential people or a lot of residents say, we want a dog park, but not in my neighborhood. They're afraid of the smell, afraid of the parking, afraid of other people coming into their neighborhood from the outside, all these other reasons. And then on the opposite end of the dog park was this big regional recreation center. And I thought, well, this is kind of unique, but it's similar to situations in Santa Fe. I'm going to go take a look at this. And I literally spent a day and a half over there just watching and talking to people and collecting ideas. And to bring some closure to that story, what I found out was that the city of Tucson did a lot of talking to people before they built the dog parks. And initially the push was to put them out in isolation, out on the what they call Chato's land end of Tucson, where the city wasn't yet, kind of like where we are at 595. And what folks were saying was, no, this is the park that I take my kids to. This is the park that's close to my house. Why are you isolating me and my dogs? Okay, I'm okay with a 40-acre open space park, but I really want something next to my house. So they have quite a few parks that are an acre or less, or an acre or more in Tucson.
And do the dog walkers, dog owners, help to actually maintain the parks?
Not on the paid end, but on the sweat equity end, this really interesting dog culture has evolved. And what I found out in talking to people, it's kind of the same folks that are there every day, much like maybe where we're sitting right here
in
the
Santa Fe Bacon Company. Yeah. They're called regulars.
They're called regulars. So the dog park regulars, quite a few of them were there, and you could tell. They would walk up and they would greet each other. They knew each other's name. They knew each other's dogs. They knew if the dog had been sick the week before, just like people are asking about kids when drop them off at the grade school. And the other interesting dynamic about that is, on their own, they had set up this little poster board saying, if you need help, if somebody needs to buy a dog, look for my lost dog, that kind of thing. And they were also coaching the newcomers that were coming into the dog park. And the expectation was, you get out of your car, your dog is on a leash. You come into the dog park, and if your dog is aggressive, you go over to this separate fenced area. I don't necessarily mean a big dog. I just mean an aggressive, unsocialized dog. And attached to that is, if your dog was socialized, didn't matter about the size, you were accepted. into the other dog park community. And the folks would go in and sit down on the benches, take the dogs off leash, and the dogs would take off, roll, tumble, drink water, slurp, jump on people. And again, if you were a newcomer, you were watched carefully. I saw one woman, she walked in there and she did not do the drill, which was to, as soon as you walk in, you go get a doggy mitt to pick up doggy stuff to put in the waste paper basket, because everyone there carried one like it was their purse or wallet.
A little trash bag.
Yeah, and they chastised her. They said, well, if you're coming to our dog park, you are welcome, but there's the sign over there with the rules, take a look at it. So this poor gal did.
We definitely found that early on at the shelter. We're a private nonprofit. We didn't need to build the dog park, but we wanted to. But as soon as you start letting people use it, there's this sense of ownership and a community building that's pretty intense.
And this is our dog park.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. There are times when it feels like, I mean, I don't really take my dogs to the shelter dog park. One of my dogs is blind, so he doesn't go there. And the other one, I don't live hugely near the shelter, so I don't go there. But I feel sometimes when I go down there that it is much more the people who are down there's dog park than it is me, an employee of the shelter.
Interesting. Now, when you observe the Santa Fe dog park, the Frank Ortiz dog park, what kind of a culture do you see there compared to what you saw in Tucson?
Well, I see a culture that's evolving. There's actually a group over there about 2 years ago who loosely organized under the term Friends of the Dog Park. And they've been asking us for information and for support. We've provided to them. On the other hand, what they're doing is they're evolving into where the Tucson groups are now, and that is they have regular cleanup days. They meet there and help each other out. They help push for improvements in the park. And it's great for us because it's like having another board or commission in the city that you really don't need to have. They'll contact us about once a month and say, is it possible to do this? Or here's a problem. Or here's what we're seeing in the parking lot. Or, you've got people coming over here dumping their trash in the garbage cans on their way to work in the morning. So they're all full, And so this culture of becoming a responsible citizen in the community and caring for and being responsible for the parks has developed at Frank Ortiz Dog Park. And it's developing in other parks that aren't dog parks in the city of Santa Fe. And what I think is going to happen, as soon as the new dog parks are up, and I do invite people to go out and look, Bill, at your parks out at the animal shelter, because they are great parks. And I think they're going to see that, a dog park is not what I'm used to thinking of in Santa Fe, the Franklin Ortiz, 20, 30 acres open space just out in the middle of nowhere. I think they're going to see the possibilities and really accept some more dog parks in town.
One of the coolest dog parks I ever saw was in Seattle, and it was a really fairly small dog park, maybe a quarter of an acre, maybe a little smaller, and it was in the middle of a proper, very large city park. But none of those dogs were having a bad time because it was a quarter of an acre. I mean, it was in the middle of the city, it was fairly small, and they were having just a blast, an absolute blast. And it's clear that dog parks are like dogs. There's a whole bunch of different kinds, but they're all pretty fantastic.
One of the things that is great about the existing dog park, the Frank Ortiz, is that it's so hilly that not only your dogs, but you yourself get exercise. So it's even without meaning to, because there's almost no place that you can walk there where it's flat, except in the very beginning of the entrance area. So it really works out for everybody.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, a lot of folks say, can you get out there and get more trash cans, maybe do some grading, because I like to walk the perimeter while my dog is running around. So that's one of the things we're looking at for the future.
When we were talking about community building, one of the interesting things about dog parks, I think, is that you tend to, I find that in dog parks, a lot of the people don't know each other's names, but everybody knows each other's dogs.
There's dogs' names.
Absolutely.
In fact, if somebody else goes with your dog, they think it's you. They don't even know what the people
absolutely.
Look like.
You're kind of interchangeable, but the interactions between the humans and other people's dogs are really sort of the centerpiece. I do think a lot of people talk. You certainly see at Frank Ortiz, there's the fitness folks who are walking, but there are also the people who sort of cut their dogs loose and everybody goes, 6 or 8 or 10 people sit in chairs and chit-chat while their dogs tool around. But it really is, it's so much about the animals, and it's so much about these relationships between them.
I have to say, the keeping your dogs on the leash while they get out of the car, which is something that I don't usually do, is really important to do. And I'm starting to get into the habit of doing it. I took all three of my dogs yesterday. The car was in car repair. I took the dogs to car repair at the end of the day to meet the mechanic. It was about four steps from my car to the door of the auto shop. And somewhere in those four steps between the door of my car and the auto shop, my dogs discovered that there were cats in the parking lot. They chased about five cats up five trees, and it was sort of chaotic. And if I just had them on the leash for those four steps, and that happens a lot at the dog park, they get distracted by something and they have to go running, and it's a little bit chaotic.
It's really important to remember that the dog park is not your yard. And for neophytes to dog parks, there is a certain baseline etiquette that you want to follow, and you can sort of feel out things from there. But people make certain assumptions about other dogs based on their own dog's personality. And you may have the most amazing, wonderful, social, dog-friendly dog in the world, but it's really not a great idea to assume that all other dogs are like that. I've certainly had experiences where I keep my dog, who's sometimes unpredictable, on a leash, and another dog will come running up in a leash walking area. And you have to say, you know, they say, don't worry, my dog's friendly. You have to say, yeah, mine's not always, though. So maintaining those etiquettes, knowing what you really should be doing in order to be as friendly as possible with everybody else. We say the word community over and over again, but that's really at the heart of it. It's sharing a space and being willing to protect your animal and other animals, as well as your neighbors, while you're in that space.
Bill, thanks. I'm sorry, but thanks for pointing that out, because other than complaints in other parks about people not picking up their dog mess, the next large complaint is, we've got an aggressive dog over here, and folks are saying, there's nothing wrong with my dog, it's you. And we'll send a code enforcement officer or park workers there doing work and makes observations, and what they see is a very aggressive behavior on the part of a dog that maybe the owner doesn't see at their home. So what I want to do is just validate what you're saying. When you go to the dog park, please have your dog on leash till you and the dog figure out who's at the party.
Yeah,
and what
absolutely.
The etiquette is.
Pay attention. It's just a little bit of observation that keeps everybody safe.
There's also there's a sort of fine line there, because sometimes some dog will be aggressive. I have three small dogs, and some dog, you know, larger, the same size, will be a little bit aggressive toward it. And I figure I kind of leave them alone until it starts getting really dangerous. In other words, I draw the line pretty far out, because my dogs need to be socialized, and they need to realize that they don't have a really high place in the hierarchy and that they're not big. And, you know, until one of my dogs was actually really pinned to the ground and terrified, he thought he was big. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to kind of realize also that they're animals and that they are utterly and completely hierarchical.
We hope that by having these three individual dog parks at the shelter, it will have all our community dog park and all of the city's good community dog parks that are coming down the pike. Those will be great places for dogs that are at least moderately well socialized. But if you have one of those dogs that really would love to run around in the dog park but really probably shouldn't pal around with other dogs, hopefully this will address some of that issue and give even those dogs who do deserve a chance to run around a place to do so.
Because dogs are people too.
Absolutely. Dogs are people too, but not always dog people.
And we haven't talked about cats today at all, but we would like to give a shout out to the wonderful cat owners of Santa Fe who have on more than one occasion complained to me. But you know, you don't need cat parks. Cats are wild animals. We don't have this problem. Dogs are people. Cats are animals.
We do have at the shelter a couple of, we call them Camp Kitty, and they're a couple of fairly large outdoor enclosures where the cats like to play. But honestly, if you're the kind of person that wants to drive your cat to a community enclosed area where it can run around with other cats, Lord, there's something horribly wrong with you.
If I could just get in here, I think that I think you really need to save this for the fun drive, kids.
And that's coming up soon, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it is. March 29th.
Fun drive, and Dal Dierman, general manager, weighing in.
Dal is like the UN of dog and cat.
Yeah, we had a good one last time, and we'll do it again. Bill, there are animals ready to be adopted at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, and we want to give you the opportunity to tell us about the wealth of cuteness.
There's one in particular that I want somebody to go out and see, mostly because I've really gotten overly attached to this dog, and I cannot take him home because of my aforementioned dog, unfriendly dog. But he's this wonderful terrier mix. He's about 2 or 3, maybe 50 pounds. He's gray and white. We call him Ivan. He's
a 50-pound terrier?
He's a mix. I'm not sure exactly what we're calling him, but he's a large terrier breed. His name's Ivan. He's missing his right front leg. Sometimes I'll run with him at the shelter, and I get tired much sooner than he does, despite the fact that I have all of my limbs intact. He's not a really dog-friendly dog, so he needs somebody who's going to, A, work with him, but also, B, probably doesn't have a dog now. But this dog is he's really unbelievable. He's so attuned. He's so into being a dog. He's so into being with people. And we've had him at the shelter for a while. So I'm hoping somebody will go out and look at him. We also have Francis, who's my other special project right now. Francis is a cat who's not a cat person. Francis has been having to live in our small mammal room because if she even sees another cat, she squeaks. And we actually have changed her name.
Squeaks?
We changed her name. I'd forgotten about this until I said this, to Squeakers, because that's exactly what she sounds like. She sounds like a bathtub toy that doesn't ever stop getting squeezed. But she's really a...
You're trying to get people to take that cat home.
I'm being straight up about the reason that these animals may have been at the shelter for a little bit longer than normal. But they really are superb, and I wouldn't be trying to involve the community in their lives if I didn't think they were great animals. But Squeakers, the cat, and Ivan, the three-legged dog, are so good. You can see pictures of both of them on our website at www.sfhumanesociety.org. As well as all of our other adoptable animals. That's updated every hour, so you can see who is in there even as we speak.
Do you still have an overabundance of cats?
We have a lot of cats. It has slowed down, however. But still, the Santa Fe I don't know that I would necessarily still categorize it as a crisis right now.
You wouldn't categorize it
that
way?
Wouldn't categorize it as a crisis, but we're all profoundly aware and quivering with fear at the fact that the weather is warming up, and that means another breeding season is quickly upon us.
Ladies and gentlemen, spay and neuter your animals.
Can't underscore it enough, folks, because somebody's dealing with the problem.
Fabian Chavez is the director of parks for the city of Santa Fe. If people want to reach you or get make comments about their needs as park goers or anything like that, how do they get in touch with the city?
Well, simply call our office directly at 955-2114. If somebody's out of the office, that's my direct line. But if I'm out of the office, I will make sure that either I return your call, or if you leave enough information about what it is you're asking for, instead of making a call and then a second call, I can put you in touch with one of our project managers or a park supervisor or park foreman that can answer your question as soon as possible. And thanks for asking that question, because as we move forward with park improvements, one of the things we will be doing is visiting with neighborhoods in and around those parks. So folks, be on the lookout for notices in the paper or signage up in the park, and because it's always unfortunate when folks come to us afterwards and say, well, I didn't know and nobody contacted me. And I always feel bad about that, but we do try to do our due diligence.
Well, Fabian Chavez, thank you so much. And Bill Hutchison of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, how do people get in touch with you there?
You can phone the shelter at 983-4309, or you can always email me at bhutchison@sfhumanesociety.org.
And with that, it is time to go. We will see you in about a month, the first Wednesday of April.
And we'll be in our fun drive.
We will be in our fun drive, and we'll be talking about
dogs,
the true rulers of the universe, and cats, their unworthy opponents.
Could you not get us firebombed at least until April, please?
Okay, we're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Natalie Goldberg. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome writer and teacher Natalie Goldberg. She has a new book, Old Friend from Far Away, The Practice of Writing Memoir, and she will be speaking on Saturday, the 8th of March at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you so much.
So we've talked about this a little bit before, because I think you were teaching a workshop on writing memoir, but let's address this again. What is a memoir?
Well, memoir is something that people used to write at the end of their life. You'd look back and reflect. But now memoir is written, because this is such an innovative country, we took memoir, a very age-old form, and cracked it open so that people can write it at any time. At, you know, 25, you can decide to reflect on your life and write a memoir, which is a really healthy thing. And memoir comes from the French, and so it's really the study of memory and how we remember and how we perceive our lives. And that's what you really hand over onto the page. It's not a chronological listing of your life, A, B, C. It's more records how you remember and how memory works.
And so what, I mean, it seems like there's really some potentially different functions of this. One is to go over your life and to remember and sort of make sense of things for your own sake and maybe for those who really love you a whole lot to read. And then there's something which might be of interest to a greater audience.
Yeah, you know, anything is of interest of a greater audience. It matters how you write it. You know, people think, I say to people, if you've lived 20 years, you don't need to live anymore. You can write for the rest of your life. There's enough material. But it's how you approach it and the depth of how you go into it. That's what really matters. I just read a wonderful memoir called Flora's Daughter by Patricia Hampel. She lived her whole life in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it's an exquisite memoir. You're fascinated from the beginning to the end. And nothing really happens.
Really?
Yeah, that's
what's so interesting about it.
Because she stops and notices her life and has an intimacy with it.
So there's, I mean, in your book, which I read, a lot of the book is exercises that people can do, and probably a lot of people know your work because of the 10-minute writing exercises, which are kind of open-ended, and the idea is just to keep moving and
yes,
don't stop and revise and edit, but to keep going. It seems like a lot of them are about remembering sensory detail.
Yeah, not just sensory detail. There's also a lot that's, yes, but sensory detail is really important because it makes the work alive and it makes it communicate to the reader. But there's a lot of other things in here, every little corner I try to get. But just since I wrote the book, you can't cover everything.
No.
I have a student who was telling me, I was on book tour and he was in Phoenix. I didn't know he was the general manager for Four Seasons Hotels. He started telling me hotel stories.
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought, oh, my God, I'd never thought of putting hotels in here. And last night, I teach with Rob Wilder, the writer. We teach at IAIA, and last night we taught. And the students, we were talking about when you went on school trips, you know, those day trips.
Oh, yeah.
I never thought of putting that in there. So it's wonderful because it's endless. Writing never ends. You never do a book and you're done.
So you have published memoirs yourself.
Yes, this is my 11th book. The last book I wrote, The Great Failure, is a memoir about my father and my Zen teacher, Katagiri Roshi. I wrote a memoir called Long Quiet Highway that came out in 1992 about my life with teachers, you know, starting with my grammar school teachers. And I also wrote Living Color, A Writer Paints Her World. I've painted for as long as I've written, for 35 years.
And so it's interesting because you were in this book, Old Friend from Far Away, you were talking about having written this memoir about your father and your spiritual teacher, and you basically went to everybody who you knew who had studied with the spiritual teacher and sort of warned them in advance that that you had written this, the book was coming out. And then when it came out, you were met with a wall of silence.
Yes, because that's the Zen way. Instead of them calling me and saying, Nat, I'm mad at you, or, you know, it didn't matter if you tell someone in advance. When the book actually comes out, people have reactions. And in the Zen way, they had no reaction.
Or they had reactions that they kept their mouth shut about.
Yes, but it was more painful for me because they kind of disappeared on me. And actually, I've never reconnected with them. And the book came out 4 years ago. But what was wonderful for me, a Zen teacher in Santa Cruz, California, who I lost her friendship to 3 weeks ago, she called me and said, Natalie, I revisited the book, and I realized I couldn't take in what you were saying, and it's a wonderful book. And that meant a great deal.
Wow.
Yeah, it meant a great deal to me, because now she's 80, and I was afraid I'd never see her again.
It does raise an interesting question, which is, what is the two-way street when you write a memoir? In other words, you write it and you put it out there. What are you hoping for in return, and what do you get in return?
That's a very good question. You know, writers are naive and innocent, and they think what they write will wake the world up. And, you know, they'll
It'll
connect.
It'll change the world.
Yeah, and you'll get love. But that doesn't always happen. You write something, and you can't control the way people react to it. And that's why I address this in several chapters, because one of the questions, I just came back from a three-week tour, book tour around the country, and one of the main questions was, well, what are people going to do if I don't want them to be mad at me? And I said, you can't control them, and that you should write down the story anyway, and then you'll decide. You know, but you can't decide before you even write it. You'll decide if you want to try to publish it or let it out. But one of the stories they love is I say to them, you know, when my family's in denial, I have the naive idea that my books will wake them up. If they're in denial, they're going to stay in denial. And so they'd read my book and skip over the parts they didn't like.
Very you know. Interesting. We're talking to Natalie Goldberg. Well, I mean, and that is a question that you address in a lot of this book is the question of self-censorship and how to get around that.
Yes, yes, because we are so self-centered that you don't even get anything down on the page.
So self-censoring.
Yeah, self-censoring.
We're probably self-centered, too.
Yeah, I realized I said that. That's another problem.
Well, I mean, and that is a problem in if you're writing memoir, I mean, on some level, you better be self-centered because it's about you, no?
Yes.
Or is that not true?
You have to be self-centered in that way. You have to have a fascination for your life. And a confidence in your experience that it's rich enough to write about. But if it's self-centered, the actual writing, you're lost. Because what you want to do is communicate it so other people are interested.
It's an interesting borderline that you're walking there. I had on the air last year a young writer named Dar Jamail who wrote a book called Beyond the Green Zone, and it's about his work as a journalist in Iraq. And it was such it's not a memoir, it's a piece of journalism, but it's so interesting because you really see and feel his movement on the ground, walking around. You have a lot of sense of him, but it's so not about him. It's about the people that he was talking to and about the world there and about the bombs dropping and so on. And I realize that it's really a feat that you can accomplish as a writer to be in it and not really have it be centered on you.
Well, I've got a secret for you. That's how memoir should be, too. Even though it's about your life, you give the details over in a way. They're no longer yours. You make them clear enough so that you're not so attached to them anymore. And you hand them over and let go of them. In a way, what's great about memoir, it's a way of letting go of your life. So maybe when you die, you'll be used up. I think we all want to be used up before we die.
What does that mean?
It means that you don't have any regrets, that you fully lived your life and given your life over to the world and to other people.
Well, and that brings up another potential paradox, which is that when you are writing about something in great detail, you're really holding on to it. And so where does the process occur between really holding on and letting go?
No, you're not holding on. You're seeing it clearly, and you're having an intimacy. But, you know, true intimacy, you know you can't hold on. You'll smother it, and the intimacy dies. So actually, it's not holding on. It's finally, when you really get it on the page clearly, you're letting go.
Now, how important is it in a memoir to actually tell a story?
I think you have to have some kind of narrative. You have to have a reason to turn the page. You know, otherwise, you know, you just write about a blade of grass, you know, and it just is one blade of grass. But when a caterpillar comes along, suddenly there's a story.
Is there?
Yeah, the caterpillar crawls up the grass and the grass bends. There's an interconnection. Something goes on. And I think there has to have something like that. But it's not like plot in a novel. it's something else carries a memoir. Sometimes just the depth of intimacy with a person's life. Because it's not the structure of A, B, C. Remember I said that it's really following memory and the way memory works.
Well, there's this writer named Sandra Cisneros who was a famous and wonderful writer in the sense that she had incredible memories of her past and her childhood, and you felt like you were there, but there were no stories, and the work ended up being just deadly boring because there were no stories. There was no conflict resolution.
Really? Yeah. Which book are you talking about?
That first one, which was all those,
Mango
I can't remember the name
Street.
Of it. I think so.
That's a very famous book.
I know.
Yeah, you might have thought it was boring. I thought it was a great book.
Oh, God, I thought it was deadly because there were no stories in it.
Well, there were stories. It was a story of her life. But most human lives aren't, you know, that exciting. And she's giving you her sidewalk.
Exactly.
Yeah,
well, maybe there's just a difference in taste and what people like. But
yes.
Eventually, I mean, you quoted in this book a wonderful and somewhat several pages long piece of the memoir of James Baldwin.
Yes.
And that is a story. That's a real story.
Well, he talks about his life with tremendous intimacy, and there's a great muscle behind it. But really, what is he doing? He's just describing his father. There's not a story there.
Well, there is in the sense that there is the whole set of conflicts embodied in the race relations of the time in which he was living.
Yeah, but it was more the conflict between him and his father,
right,
which he captures. And I see, I like Sandra, I like her work, and I respect it, and I can't remember Mango Street, it's been a while. But in there's also a story. It didn't appeal to you, probably, but there's a story.
Well, what
there is
a story?
A story is something, well, that's a good question. A story is something where you can dream a little, where you can dream yourself into it. And it kind of goes along, and it connects people up, and it connects worlds up. It connects the sidewalk with the car driving by, and the grass, and you in this sitting on the curb. You know, it's something that connects things up.
See, I thought it was something where, at the end, there is something that is significantly different and even opposite from the beginning.
Yeah, that's an old-fashioned idea. You're back in the
old
world.
I'm old-fashioned,
yeah,
Natalie.
I know. Aren't you from the South?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were.
No.
Okay.
It's just my name. It sounds
okay.
That way. We're talking to Natalie Goldberg, and the book is called Old Friend from Far Away. What? Tell us about the title.
The title actually comes from Confucius, from the Analects of Confucius. To see an old friend from far away. What a delight. And isn't memory really an old friend from far away?
When you are teaching people, and you've been teaching for decades. What did you say, 35 years?
Yeah, because before I taught writing practice, I was a public school teacher.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's one of the most proud things that I've done. I have a teaching certificate, and I love to teach. And actually, Old Friend from Far Away, I wanted... My challenge here was to give people the experience of what it's like to be in the classroom with you,
mm-hmm,
with me.
Right.
And so really, I'm messing with your mind here. I don't let you settle. I'm working you constantly.
I know. I mean, it's a command form, some of the chapters.
Yes.
It's like, you know,
go,
here's,
do this,
go, 10
yes,
minutes.
I know. I'm very bossy. I'm bossy as a teacher, and I'm bossy in this book. Actually, you know... Joan Halifax, the Zen teacher at Upaya, she read it ahead of time to write a blurb. And ever since then, every time I see her, she says to me, go, go.
Right. Now, one of the other things that you talk about that's very important is daily practice and continuous practice. What do you do and what do you encourage your students who really want to write memoir or write other forms to do in terms of their daily practice?
Well, you know, everyone says daily practice, but I don't actually in the book say daily practice because it's sort of like a diet. If you say you're going to go on a diet and then you don't do it one day, you quit completely.
Yeah, and you eat chocolate bars immediately.
Yes, exactly. So what I'm more realistic, look at your schedule. If that this week you can only write for a half hour on Tuesday and an hour on Friday afternoon, put it in your schedule. You know how Americans love our little schedules. And put it in there and show up as though it were a doctor appointment. Go. And so the continual doesn't mean every day, but it means continually having a relationship with it. But also writing is a whole way of life. So when you're not writing, you're also seeing and absorbing as a writer. Jack Kerouac says, open listening.
And when you shift your focus to doing that kind of open listening, how do things change and how do you record all your impressions? I mean, we have so many impressions all day long and most of them are lost.
Yeah, you don't worry about it. You just sort of absorb things, and then when you open your notebook and start writing, whatever you grab is okay. But it's a way of receiving the world. The other part of Jack Kerouac's thing is be submissive to everything, open listening, which is a wonderful way of being in the world.
You don't usually think of Jack Kerouac and submissive in the same sentence.
No, you don't.
Sentence.
No, you don't. But, you know, we writers have our tricks up our sleeve.
So do you think when people do their, whether it be their 10-minute writing exercises or whatever, it seems like you think it's important to write longhand?
Well, I think it's important, just like if you know how to drive a car, you can't forget how to walk. You know, you might not be able to pay your electric bill someday, and you have to hock your computer. You should, or if you're out hiking, there should be no excuse not to write. And I like to keep it very democratic in a way, and everybody can afford to write. Pen and paper, anybody can get that. And really, it's the original way most of us learned to write. I don't know if now people learn to write on a computer first, but it's physical. It's your arm and your shoulder connected to your heart. But I also, it's okay to write on a computer. I just say it's a different physical activity, so a slightly different bent of mind comes out. Not better or worse, just different.
You start the book, writing is an athletic activity. It comes from the whole body, your knees, arms, kidneys, fingers, lung, and spine. But, I mean,
yes,
that's not about writing with a pen or pencil.
Well, it is, well, yes, you're writing with the pencil. You're using the pencil to express your knees, arms, toes. Your whole body is in there. And so when I teach, I tell students, I don't want you to take notes because I want your whole body to absorb it. Because it comes from the whole body. You know, when I'm really writing, my whole body is writing. And just like you said, sense impressions are really important. And your body knows those sense impressions.
Right, right. So you've been teaching for all of these years, over 3 decades. How have you seen your students, I mean, you have students year after year, workshop after workshop, have they changed, or do you basically see the same kinds of things coming out of them and the same kind of responses to what you do?
Oh, I think, well, I have to say, happily, people are still in love with what I do. You know, they're sort of stunned by it. But the reason is because I'm teaching something that should have been taught in high school. I don't have these highfalutin ideas about what I'm teaching. It's very basic things that I'm teaching that were not covered or understood in high school. The difference I do see, like I was in Iowa City, of course, I'm getting older, excuse me, and they're getting younger. In Iowa City, I looked out at the audience and I kept saying, did a high school come here? Did a high school class come? And they all shook their head. I said, there must be a high school. You all look so young. And one woman raised her hand and I said, ah, here we have an example of a 14-year-old. And she said, I'm 26.
Right.
Of course, she was insulted because when you're young, you don't want to be told that you look young.
Right.
I said, wait until you're my age. You'll love right. it.
Yeah, I think there's a line somewhere that occurs at approximately 35 or something.
Yeah.
Where it flips to the other direction. That's interesting that you say this should be taught in high school. What is it about what you're doing that isn't being taught in high school? What is it that it brings out in the person?
First of all, how to write, to have a confidence in your experience and a trust in your mind, and to trust what you think, see, and feel, which is so important, really, for bringing up citizens, you know, so that you can question clearly. You have a thinking mind. You have your own mind. you know what you see, think, feel, and see.
Right.
You know, and I think one of the problems are we're not taught that. But also, writing is a very basic thing, just like reading. I think it should be in the Declaration of Independence. What is it? Freedom, liberty, the pursuit of
life,
happiness.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, dash, and writing.
Natalie Goldberg would like to revise our documents.
I would. I want people to write because I think it's a way to stay connected with ourselves and intimate.
Well, it's interesting the connection you're making between being a good citizen and self-knowledge. In other words, the better you know yourself, the better you can connect to the world around you.
Yes, and you can question things and have a relationship with things and with politics and, you know, care about the world. So it's I just think it's a very basic human activity to write. Trees don't do it, birds don't, sky doesn't, it's only human beings.
That's an excellent point. What is the, and I know we've talked about this a little bit before, but what is the relationship for you and for your students, or maybe not for your students, between writing and meditation practice?
I have a secret for people. Writing practice is a legitimate Zen practice, and actually doing it really is like meditating or slow walking. It's a different practice. It's a different physical practice, but it's a deep meditation practice.
And so that's what you use for yourself instead of sitting?
No, I also sit, and I also do walking. And when I teach workshops, I also teach retreats, silent retreats, where we sit, walk, write. And it's another relationship with the human mind.
Now, you do a lot of traveling and teaching out of town. Do you also teach here in Santa Fe, where you live?
Mostly I teach, actually. I can't travel as much. It's just too exhausting. I don't do it as much as I used to. I mostly teach at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House in Taos. I teach week-long workshops. And also, I'm teaching in April a two-day memoir workshop. And I sometimes teach at UPAYA. And Miriam Sagan and I are teaching a workshop called Doodling Hearts, Love and Writing Together. And then Rob Wilder and I are teaching at IAIA together. So I like to do a few local things, but basically I think you have to come up to Taos to work with me.
Well, Natalie Goldberg, thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, I hope I see people at Collected Works.
Yes, that is this Saturday at 4 o'clock, March 8th. Collected Works Bookstore is on West San Francisco Street, pretty much across the street from the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. And the book is called Old Friend from Far Away, The Practice of Writing Memoir. Thanks again.
It was great. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents Women in Jazz and a visit from Santa Fe Symphony Music Director Stephen Smith. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.